Hi, I'm David Crowe. Thank you for tuning in to episode 192 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. Email me at david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crow with an E. Join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Infectious Myth. Listen every Tuesday at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time on prn.fm or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or other podcast programs. You can listen to any of the last five episodes over the phone by dialing the U.S. number 701-719-0990 and following the instructions. Just remember that you'll be responsible for any long-distance charges. I don't know that you're a listener until I hear from you, so send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show and what you like about it. If you include your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift, which will be one of the bookmarks I make by hand using my own photographs. If you'd like to sponsor the show, please contact me. You can make a one-time donation via PayPal using the email david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com, or you can make monthly donations at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. That's P-A-T-R-E-O-N. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want this show to continue to grow and improve, consider paying a small amount for the information that you are gleaning, for the support you get for some non-mainstream ideas, and the challenges you get to others. If you'd like me to speak at the meeting of an organization you're a member of on just about any of the topics I've covered in my shows, I'd be happy to discuss this. I appreciate you commenting and suggesting guests. I appreciate your financial support as well. Thanks for listening and for recommending this show to your friends. A little bit of feedback. Martin Barnes wrote regarding episode 189, which was related to homeopathy in Canada. Great interview on homeopathy, says Martin. Thank you, and please keep the comments coming. Today I want to talk about the 1629 to 1632 plague of Milan, Italy. This might seem to be a strange thing to talk about now, so a little background about how I got there. It was in the mid to late 1990s that I first heard the incredible idea, or at least it was, seemed incredible at the time, that HIV did not actually exist. I obtained a package of scientific papers written by the so-called Perth Group and was fascinated by their detailed analysis for the lack of evidence that HIV had ever been purified, let alone proven to exist, let alone proven to be the cause of any disease. When I'd fully absorbed this and decided that the Perth Group were right, along came the West Nile epidemic, as it was called, in New York City in 1999. I decided to obtain the relevant scientific papers making claims about the existence of the virus and causation, and to apply a Perth-like analysis. I did this and satisfied myself that West Nile virus also had not been proven to exist. I even eventually obtained the 1940 paper describing the first so-called outbreak of West Nile virus disease in Uganda in the late 1930s, which was published in the American Journal of Tropical Medicine, with the title, A Neurotropic Virus Isolated from the Blood of a Native of Uganda. Amusingly, in a dark way, the paper began with a strange paragraph. An African woman aged 37 years was seen by one of us, Burke, in December 1937 in a Mogo West Nile district, northern province of Uganda. The woman reported to the officers of the sleeping sickness survey and was not subjected to any other examination than what is usual in the routine survey, except that her temperature was taken. Her oral temperature was at 100.6 degrees Fahrenheit. She denied feeling ill, perhaps to avoid hospitalization. Nevertheless, a sample of her blood was taken and serum from it was inoculated intracerebrally, directly into the brain of mice. The woman was not seen again until 3 months later, when another specimen of her blood was taken. At this time, she denied that she had been ill at or near the time she was seen in the previous December. She was not altogether cooperative, and it is possible that she withheld pertinent facts. Of the 10 mice inoculated with the original blood serum of this woman, only one survived. The others became ill 6 to 8 days after inoculation and either died or were sacrificed for sub-inoculations. The infectious agent was readily established in mice and was preserved for months in the frozen state. Sub-inoculations in series have been done by injecting each mouse intracerebrally with 0.03 cc's of the supernatant from a suspension of infected mouse brain and saline. The virus is now, it was September 15th, 1939, in its 53rd passage, and there have been no survivors since the first mouse passage. So a little bit of an explanation of what was going on here. They took blood from this woman, and they took the serum, that is, the liquid around the blood, the liquid without the blood cells, although it will contain parts of broken blood cells and many other physical things, not just a pure liquid. It was injected directly into the brain of mice, and it killed the mice. There was no control, so we don't know if blood similarly processed from healthy people would also have killed the mice. After the first round, where they used the woman's blood, they then ground up the brains of the brains of the mice, and they took the liquid off this, and they injected that into more mice, and they were able to kill all of the mice doing this. At no point did they purify a virus, and at no point without a control did they prove that this virus that they hadn't shown was actually there, was actually pathogenic. Without a control, we don't really know if their problem was just that they weren't really very good at sterilizing the needles, and so as they injected a needle into the brain of a mouse, they killed them, or perhaps the people wielding the needles were a little bit rough and therefore killed the mice by trauma to the brains. A lot of these things could be decided with a control. If you had a control injecting human blood or other mouse brains that you didn't think had the virus into the brains, and there were no deaths, then you would have something. But you might find that you would get a similar rate of deaths with material that you believed was not infectious. Anyway, I'm not saying that West Nile was the cause of the Milan epidemic. I was just explaining my logic for deciding that West Nile was not actually a viral disease. Anyway, by coincidence, about 10 years after looking at West Nile, I was studying Italian, and by another coincidence, I was assigned to read the weighty novel I Promessi Sposi, The Betrothed Couple, by the 19th century novelist Alessandro Manzoni. This novel is famous, or perhaps infamous, in Italy because many high school students are forced to read it. It's one of those sweeping historical dramas based loosely on true events of the mid-1600s, which included wars, and a very detailed description of how the young man, who was at that time in the novel separated from his would-be bride, and I can tell you the novel had a happy ending, so you can maybe feel good about that. He ended up in Milan during the plague. I learned also that Manzoni hadn't just dreamed this up, but he'd taken the description of the plague from an Italian language report commissioned by the city fathers of Milan shortly after the epidemic, and I managed to obtain a copy. I wanted to ask the question, what evidence is there in this report that the epidemic of illness was actually infectious and not caused by famine, poverty, and war, which were rampant at that time? I had looked at the plague at that time, but more recently I was preparing to give a talk on viruses at a conference in Vers-Pont-de-Gard in the south of France in June of this year, June of 2018. And so I did a more detailed analysis. It isn't all that easy to read Italian from the 1600s, especially not being a native Italian speaker. There are things like all the V's are written as U's and vice versa, and what looks like a B is actually an S, and other things like that. There are some words that are no longer in common use. Perhaps the worst thing is that the concept of sentence didn't appear to exist, at that time, and most paragraphs were a single, incredibly long sentence. So it's really hard to keep track of what's actually going on in the sentence. But I did manage to find some very interesting things to report to the conference, and now I can report to you. The title page, translated to English, is the following. Information and on the origin and following days of the Grand Pestilence. Contagious, poisonous, and evil in the city of Milan and its duchy from 1629 to 1632. With the following predictions and orders. Adding a brief compendium of the different types of pestilence that occurred at different times. Divided into two parts. One, from the creation of the world until the birth of Jesus. Two, from Our Lady until present times. With a list of several antidotes. Written by Alessandro Tadino, medical physician and the conservers of the illustrious Tribunal of Health of the State of Milan. Addressed to the Third Signore Francesco Origone, Vicar of Provisions of the City and Duchy of Milano, published Milan, 1648. How do we know that this was an epidemic? Can we say it was an epidemic because Alessandro Tadino said it was infectious and poisonous, not just on his title page, but many times throughout this report? Did he have the capacity to see the pathogen? No. Even if this was a bacterial pathogen in the 1630s, he would not have the ability to visualize it. And if it was a virus, then it was not until the advent of the electron microscope in the 1930s that anybody could possibly see something that small. Did he have any kinds of scientific tests? No. There was a description of some truly bizarre experiments that went on, which I will describe later, are very difficult to believe actually happened as described. But there was nothing approaching a scientific test that could detect a virus or bacteria. They weren't even very good at maintaining a consistent list of symptoms. Another way to look at it is, what if in his report he described beliefs and statements that we would say today are clearly irrational? If that was the case, why would we believe him when he says that the statements, that the epidemic was infectious? For example, statements on recommended antidotes or treatments, the causes of the plague, and preventives. Here's an example of Tadino's logic. Destruction was great in Calvenzano Gerardada, where the poison came from a single young woman who had received an apron from an infected house. From this one case, 732 people died due to lack of supplies to extinguish the contagion, and it would have proceeded in a cruel manner to destroy everyone in the surrounding area if it wasn't for the intercession of the saints Sebastian and Rocco. The locals were devoted to these saints, which resulted in the liberation and good health of families. In recognition of this, a church was dedicated to the saints. These saints also interceded to liberate many other houses from contagion and illness. So that we can see that places that appeared to be immune from the plague were not considered to be immune because perhaps people in those areas had adequate food in a time of war and famine that affected many places. Perhaps there weren't very many poor people in that area, or if they were poor, they worked on farms and had access to food. No, the reason for the good health of these areas was because these people prayed to the right saints. I think we can say that that would be an irrational viewpoint. And if that's the level of logic, it doesn't really say much for somebody assuming that they're dealing with an infectious epidemic. Now, here's the closest thing to a scientific experiment in this report. Quote, "This is the report of the doctor and lawyer Giuseppe Dondeo, a person worthy of faith. In September 1630, While he was responsible for cases of plague in Tortona, which is in Volpedo, the place of the great hospital. They killed some delinquents who confessed to having fabricated the unto, the poisoned ointment, which I will discuss later. A wheat mill was poisoned, and on a table, on a piece of canvas stretched out before this man who had found the truth and proof about the ointment, he took four loaves and rubbed them with the poison, which was a dark yellow color. It was then given to some hens and some other animals to eat at their leisure. And in the space of half an hour, they were all dead. The visitors saw that their flesh was all black, and their insides were black and rotted. Can we believe Alessandro Tadino when he tells about this story? He didn't get it directly. He did not see this, but he obtained it from a doctor and a lawyer, as he says, a person worthy of faith. But in the present day, could we believe that this actually happened? Here are some of the antidotes that were listed in the report by Tadino. Children's urine, lye, hyacinth stone, which I believe is a kind of red zircon, sprinkling of wine, chicken or pigeon feces, burning laurel leaves at night, the liquid part obtained from human feces, two parts ammonia, one part myrrh mixed with wine, burning ulcerated legs with a cautery, a hot iron, antimony, a poisonous metal, arsenic, another poisonous substance, and holy candles and sacrifices to various saints, including the Virgin Mary, and 10 more similar antidotes. Again, it's hard to believe that any of this would have had any beneficial health effects. And certainly they didn't seem to do very much because the epidemic went on for 3 years. And what were some of these causes? Well, some from the report were that in 1628, the year before the start of the famine, there was a comet which Tadino assures us was caused by the conjunction of Saturn and Jupiter. I think we now know that comets have nothing to do with the conjunction of Saturn and Jupiter, which is really a non-event everywhere in the universe except on Earth, because if you were at any other viewing point in the universe, the two planets would converge at different times. It all depends on your viewpoint. Comets, unless they come close to a planet, are unaffected by planets. Anyway, other causes he listed were eclipses. They generated a lot of fear in the Middle Ages, when people didn't understand why they would have darkness at noon. And of course, it was very easy for people to blame this on the Creator, or perhaps for religious leaders to take advantage of this, to tell people that they needed to become more religious and devote themselves more to the church, to help to enrich the church even further due to the eclipses. Winds, fog, air pollution, eating fish from a part of Italy called Lipari, other conjunctions of the planets, fumes from dead bodies, swamps, sewers, and aqueducts, cold winters and copious snow, divine anger, wicked women, always good to blame bad things on wicked women, poisoned sewing needles, poisoned wine, poisoned soap, poisoned cream, dust manufactured to be poisonous, Jews, dying locusts, whales, and dragons. Interestingly enough, Tadino talks about the famine that occurred at the same time without really seeing that there could be a great connection between the famine and the illness of so many people. He says, "To them came a famine throughout the whole state, beginning in the year 1627. That's 2 years before the famine, when D. Gonzale of Cordova ruled. A little historical side note, the Spanish ruled Milan for some time at this period, and they were accused of just trying to suck resources out of Italy to enrich the Spanish monarchy, as opposed to actually look after the people that they were in charge of ruling. He continues, this was caused not only by a mediocre harvest, but by the transfer of grain outside the state, permitted by some ministers and by the lack of loyalty of some state commissioners, who were blinded by inordinate love of money. They allowed the Grigioni, the Swiss soldiers, the Venetians and the Genoans, and many other neighboring princes to take grain. This caused a notable increase in the price of grain, which caused the opposite of what was hoped, with the greedy taking more grain that would have otherwise gone to the people. The state had less money and could only find grain at exorbitant prices. The agony of the people caused them to start saying bad things about the ministers, including complaints and agony. It has been noted by many people that famines are not really so much caused by a failure of the harvest, but by a failure of the economic system. If people believe that there is a shortage of something, they will start to hoard it. People with money will start to hoard it, the price will go up, and the poor will be unable to get it. This will increase the panic, will cause more hoarding, and the famine can go on for a long time. I remember reading that a state in India, the state itself hoarded grain when there wasn't a famine, because during a famine they could then dump it on the market, which would cause the opposite kind of panic. People who had hoarded grain thinking the price would go up would see the price going down, and then they also would dump it onto the market. And this could actually short-circuit a famine, which, as I said, is more of an economic crisis than purely an agricultural crisis. What were some of the preventives for either stopping the plague or preventing it from spreading? Well, the Italians have given a lot of words into illness and public health. Quarantine comes from the Italian quaranta, meaning 40, which means that people who are believed to be affected by the disease were quarantined, put aside, locked in their house or somewhere else for 40 days. I've always thought that this probably had more to do with the fact that in the Bible, Jesus supposedly went into the desert for 40 days and 40 nights, rather than any specific calculation. The belief being that it was infectious, and therefore if you isolate somebody for 40 days, they will no longer be infectious, and they can be let back out. Another preventive was removing the poor to a lazaretto. Lazaretto is the Italian word for a leper colony or a leper refuge or a leper prison is perhaps the better way to say it. This again has a biblical roots, because in the Bible, Lazarus was a poor man covered in sores, which most people are led to assume means that he had leprosy, who came to the door of a rich man. I don't need to go into the story, but the wealthy of Milan would set aside a lazaretto where the poor could be warehoused. I'm not sure if this was really based on charity or based on the fear that the poor were infectious, and therefore if you could keep them away from the more wealthy people, even if the poor died, they couldn't affect the wealthy. Another preventive was burning clothes from homes with a diseased person. And there were lots of references to purging, which presumably is some kind of disinfection, although it's not described in the report as far as I can see. This brings us to the topic of leprosy, which is a skin disease and seems very similar to yet another Italian word, pellagra. Pelle meaning skin and agra meaning sour. So sour skin, pellagra is now known to be a vitamin B deficiency, often caused by eating corn, maize. Maize itself is not poisonous, but if your diet only consists of corn, you end up with a vitamin B deficiency. Corn was not native to Italy or anywhere in Europe. It came from Latin America, Central America. And like many other foods that became part of the diet, so starting in the 1400s and 1500s, seeds of these miracle crops came across. Corn was very productive, and it could be very useful for feeding the poor, with nobody knowing that corn could cause this vitamin deficiency if eaten exclusively. What did they eat at the Lazaretto? One would imagine that the cheapest possible foods would be fed to them, which would probably be a corn porridge. In Italy, they refer to some things made from corn as polenta. So a weak corn porridge could keep the poor alive without too much cost to the city fathers, and without the city fathers feeling like these disgusting-looking poor people with skin sores and other symptoms of the plague would be lying around on the sidewalks. What were those symptoms? The report mentions buboes, and if you've heard of bubonic plague, they're talking about buboes. These are swelling of the lymph nodes. This is mentioned 25 times. Pimples and boils are mentioned 17 times. Fever, 5 times. Salivary gland swelling, 4 times. Tumors, which could also be skin conditions, 3 times. Blotches on the skin, twice. Petechia, a small hemorrhage under the skin, 2 times. And one word I don't know, vivici, which I haven't been able to find a definition of anywhere, but that was only mentioned once. So it appears that the majority of symptoms were the swelling of the lymph nodes and various skin conditions, and also sometimes fever. This has some similarities with pellagra, which, as I mentioned, is a skin disease. This is how an article in the Pittsburgh Gazette Times described pellagra. Outward symptoms are unmistakable. The characteristic eruption of the skin caused the disease at one time to be recognized as a type of leprosy, Italian leprosy. This skin eruption usually first attacks the arms and the back of the hands. There is a subsequent wasting of the tissues, atrophy of the heart, anemia, nervous and digestive troubles, intestinal disturbances, insanity, typhoid pellagra, and finally death. The rash or skin eruption is the characteristic and invariable symptom of the disease. It appears first on the back of the hands, the forearms, face, back of neck, upper chest, and feet. The skin in the beginning of the attack becomes red, with sensations of burning and itching, and usually some puffiness. After some days, pimples may appear, and these may fuse into large spots filled with serum. Later, the skin dries and falls in small grayish scales. At other times, the skin, after the initial redness, may take on a dark color, after which it dries and scales off. As repeated attacks occur, it gradually undergoes chronic thickening. It was believed to be infectious. For example, in a 1911 Pittsburgh Gazette article, it says, pellagra is strictly confined to those races where maize is a staple article of the diet. Under the influence of parasitic growths, and which has undergone certain chemical changes. Some investigators deny that pellagra comes from eating diseased corn. One Professor Sambon of London has been observing pellagra in Italy and is convinced that there the disease is spread by an Italian midge. This insect does not exist in the US, but it's thought probable that the buffalo gnat, an insect found chiefly in the lower Mississippi Valley, carries the poison from one person to another. So although they had connected pellagra to corn, they were so obsessed with the idea that it was an infectious disease, they couldn't see that maybe it was just corn by itself that was the cause. Note the emphasis on diseased corn, but in actual fact, if you eat perfectly healthy corn, and if that's all you eat, you will eventually get sick with pellagra. So continuing our segue into pellagra, the National Institutes of Health, which usually promotes infectious diseases, celebrates the history of Joseph Goldberger. On April 26, 1916, 5 years after the article I just quoted from, Dr. Goldberger injected 5 cc's, now called milliliters, of a pellagrin's blood into the arm of his assistant, Dr. George Wheeler. Just in case you're thinking that Goldberger was a monster, Wheeler also shot 6 cubic centimeters of such blood into Goldberger. Then they swabbed out the secretions of the pellagrin's nose. Pellagrin refers to a person with pellagra. Secretions from their nose and throat, and rubbed them into their own noses and throats. They made capsules containing scabs from the rashes of the person with pellagra, and they swallowed them. Others joined what Goldberger called his, quote, filth parties, including his wife, Mary Goldberger. None of the volunteers got pellagra. Despite Goldberger's heroic efforts, a few physicians remained staunch opponents of the dietary theory of pellagra. In an article by Scobie in the Archives of Pediatrics, 1952, several commissions appointed during the first quarter of the century to investigate the cause of pellagra concluded from their studies that pellagra was an infectious, contagious disease. Harris, in 1913, was able to inject filtered tissue material from pellagra victims into monkeys to cause a corresponding disease in these animals. He concluded from these experiments that a virus was present in the injected material and that it was the cause of pellagra. If the work of Harris had been followed exclusively, various strains of this ironic, quotes, virus might have been discovered, and a vaccine effective in experimental animals might have been developed, as in the cause of poliomyelitis. Scobie was a critic of the viral theory of polio. Today, as a result of research, we know conclusively that pellagra is not caused by a virus, but rather that it is a vitamin deficiency disease. It is obvious that if the investigations of pellagra had been restricted to the virus theory, it would still be a mystery. Now note carefully what this Dr. Harris did. He took materials from pellagra victims. He assumed that there was a virus in them. He filtered them, which basically takes out the lumps and leaves the liquid, and he injected them into monkeys. So he never proved that this liquid material actually had a virus in it. He may well have not used controls. The development of the idea that scientific experiments need to have controls was not solidified until later. And in fact, even in modern experiments, they still try to avoid proper controls in many experiments. So his experiment was really designed to support his own viewpoints. By taking this material and injecting it into monkeys, he could say, monkeys we didn't inject with this material stayed healthy, but monkeys we did got sick. He could then say that the disease was somewhat similar to pellagra, and from that conclude that a virus was present. Maybe it would be possible for him to do something that would block the disease, which he could then assume, if used on humans, would prevent pellagra. It's a good example of shoddy science, but that was actually very common at that time. It's not uncommon now. And many of our theories of disease are based on science that evolved at that time. Despite knowing how shoddy the science was back then by our best standards, and despite knowing that shoddy science can produce conclusions that are wrong, that are even opposite to the truth, we still believe many of these disease models that were generated with this bad science. In Tedino's report, he listed a lot of other occurrences of this plague, which is very interesting because given the vagueness of the symptoms, there was never a coherent discussion of how you could recognize the plague in Milan in the 1600s. It was just assumed that educated physicians and other people could recognize. There were a number of different symptoms, and who knows if earlier plagues had exactly the same symptoms and had exactly the same cause. Some of the plagues that he lists, the first one being at the time of the creation of the world. As I read on the title page, his book starts at the beginning of the creation of the world, and the first section talks about the time up to the birth of Jesus. He also refers to a plague at the time of Achilles, with a centaur named Chiron being a medic. The other biblical characters, Samuel and David, also had plagues. Homer said there was one caused by the sun. Another was described by Plutarch. There were several in Rome. In Athens, in the army of Carthage, in Egypt, in the city of Jerusalem, in AD 118, there was a plague in Africa supposedly brought by Italy. AD 158 and AD 190, there was bubonic plague throughout all the world. 664, another eclipse of the sun. In AD 1168, under Emperor Federico in Rome, there was one due to air pollution. 1219 in the Holy Land, especially afflicting arms and legs. Bubonic plague in the time of Henry, Emperor of Germany. An earlier plague in Milan in 1254, caused by air pollution. In AD 1345, there was a plague caused by Saturn, Mars, and Jupiter in conjunction. In 1346, a cold winter and copious snow caused plague in Rome. I'm skipping over most of these. Some of the more interesting ones that have causes. In AD 1534, there was a plague caused by lightning. I don't read this so much to mock Tadino's logic, although I think it's pretty easy to see that it would be impossible, based on historical documents, to say that all of these ancient plagues, even if they did actually exist, if they did actually occur, would be caused by the same pathogen that was causing the plague in Milan, if indeed it was caused by a pathogen. Moving back to the Milan plague, let's talk about some of the characters who played a role described quite vividly in Manzoni's novel. The first were the Monati. These were people who were charged with moving sick, poor people to the Lazaretto, destroying infected clothing, feeding those in quarantine, and burying the dead. They also took bribes and stole people's goods. They were in a very good position. They could show up at your house and say that they thought that your grandfather was sick with the plague. And perhaps if you paid them enough money, you could get them to ignore this and go away and say that granddad didn't really look that sick. What's really interesting about the Monati is that they didn't get sick. They were exposed to the people, they were exposed to the people's clothing, they were at the Lazaretto where all these people were supposedly infectious, and miraculously, the Monati did not get sick. Could it be that they were being paid by the city, apart from anything they got extra, such as bribes and reselling people's goods? Therefore, they could afford to feed themselves well in a time of famine, where there's not necessarily a shortage of food, there's just a high price of food. But if you have the money, you can still exist quite nicely. Another major group of people in this episode are what are called the Untioni. There is a word in English, unction, which is the act of anointing with oil. for various religious purposes. The English meaning has drifted a lot from the Italian, but it means some kind of cream or oil. And the significance for the plague is that there were believed to be evil people, the Untioni, who spread these poisons, the Unto, onto the walls of the city and caused the epidemic. And even the doctors believed this. Now, there was some dispute about what you should do about this, but most people felt that when they caught somebody, they had to be killed in the most brutal way possible. So if somebody wandered into the city, perhaps starving in the country, looking for work or food in the city, they were seen as a stranger and somebody accused them of being an Untioni, then they would be killed in the most brutal way possible. And of course, you could get them to confess. The Italians do have a history of extracting confessions under torture, like most countries, I suppose. And once you got them to confess, you had the reason to kill them. These poisons were often described as invisible. So if you spread an invisible poison on the wall, how did you know? Nobody could go to the wall and see it. It would seem rather strange to have somebody with perhaps a brush and a can spreading something on the wall. Was that actually seen, or was it just a rumor? People scared about what was happening would accuse strangers of being evil. A third group of people who played an important role were the physicians. The representatives of the medical profession share a name, but very little else with modern physicians. What could they do? They could burn. As I mentioned, one of the treatments was to burn the ulcers of somebody suffering. They could bleed people. That was very popular. And they could order preventive methods because they were often put in charge of the counterattack against the plague. So they could purge people, which I have concluded is some kind of disinfection, and they could burn clothes. And they were in charge of writing the report, which cast them as heroes for perpetuity. So, for example, Dadino wrote the following. Physicians Dadino, Carcano, and Setali didn't rest day or night, united in their zeal for public health, giving and taking orders and provisions to eradicate their common enemy, the plague. You might almost think that this was written by one of those physicians. Right, Tadino wrote it. So the physicians were, in this report, the heroes. There are many comments about how the poor were not very happy with what was going on. That was just because they weren't following the orders from the physicians. Tadino does hint at some environmental causes. He writes, "It seemed that the plagues of the past were not enough punishment for the state of Milan by the divine majesty, due to the errors and sins of the people. To them came a famine throughout the whole state, beginning in the year 1627, when Diaz Gonzale of Cordova ruled. This was caused not only by a mediocre harvest, but by the transfer of grain outside the state, permitted by some ministers and by the lack of loyalty of some state commissioners who were blinded by inordinate love of money. They allowed the Grigioni, the Swiss soldiers, the Venetians and the Genovese, and many other neighboring princes to take grain. This caused a notable increase in the price. This caused the opposite of what was hoped, with the greedy taking more grain that would otherwise have gone to the people. The state had less money and could only find grain at exorbitant prices. The agony of the people caused them to start saying bad things about the ministers, including complaints and agony." Tadino also writes about the lazaretto. "There was putrid and fetid straw in many rooms. They were never cleaned. People had to drink dirty water. There were too many poor people in cramped rooms. There was a deadly heat, which caused so many deaths, a massacre among the poor." So, can we really assume that the author, Tadino, is correct that the plague of Milan was infectious when he's clearly wrong about so much else, blaming evil spreaders of invisible poisons, blaming the planets, the stars, and the saints for either the epidemic or for the recovery from the epidemic. Todino does provide some evidence of environmental problems, although he never connects it with the actual epidemic. He connects it with the famine and starvation, but since he doesn't see the epidemic as an environmental disease, he obviously doesn't see why he should connect people starving with the fact that they're getting ill. What caused this? Poverty, inequality, colonialism, economic circumstances, bad governance, and war. Another thing that sticks out is that the Monati, who were the most in contact with the sick, apart from the sick themselves, didn't get sick. Reading the report, I concluded that the belief in the invisible pathogen was so strong, even then in the 1600s, that this was just an assumption that was never questioned. This reminds me a little bit about the West Nile virus epidemic. It occurred in hot summers in inner cities amongst people who were already sick, perhaps being treated for cancer or other conditions, in people who were very old. So there were obvious environmental or other factors that were certainly not infectious that were related to the symptoms that were being blamed on West Nile virus. But these environmental and other factors were ignored by the CDC and their supporters, who are obsessively laser-focused on viral causes only. Similarly, polio, which, based with its close correlation with the fruit harvest season, which I've mentioned before, may also be related to climatic conditions. If there is a lot of rain, then even if pesticides are sprayed, they may be washed off the fruit much better than in hot, dry years, or at least hot, dry summers, where any pesticides that are sprayed on the fruit might not be properly washed off. And if the fruit packer doesn't wash the fruit properly, they could be consumed by the end consumer, the buyer. Humans have believed in invisible infectious agents for far before the Milan epidemic of the 1600s. I've seen references to even the Romans believing in this, and I wouldn't be surprised if it goes back much further. It would be a very good way to explain why people were mysteriously getting sick, why animals were dying. Slightly more advanced than just blaming it on the wrath of the gods. But even in Roman and Egyptian times, people were playing around with toxic chemicals, especially metals like lead and mercury. And the mining would also release metals, compounds that they might not be interested in, things like arsenic. So poisoning of people was a real potential, but there seemed to be no understanding that certain things could be poisonous, or at least this was overwhelmed by the belief that if bad things happened to people, it was due to some mysterious infection and not due to environmental conditions. I think we need to reevaluate all of these old stories as best we can. It is, of course, very difficult when a report is written by somebody who fervently believes that the epidemic was infectious, who was surrounded by people who might have very different views on many things. There were may have been people who were very critical of the government. There were government supporters. But they all agreed that there was an invisible infectious agent, and it's something that nobody questioned. And it is the things in society that are just accepted, just assumed, that can be the most dangerous. Before I end, I wanted to speak in support of the free speech rights of Alex Jones and others on the so-called alt-right. In many ways, I think Alex Jones is odious. He declared that the Newtown school mass shooting was a false flag operation before backing off when threatened with lawsuits. This caused untold pain to the parents and the other loved ones of victims of that mass shooting, all to support Alex Jones' gun fetish. It's almost like he doesn't believe guns are capable of killing good people. But on the other hand, he's had good guests on subjects like vaccination. While I wouldn't object to certain of his shows and subjects being censored by the private owners of the social networks in question, a blanket ban is uncalled for. Social networks are in a difficult position because neither extreme is tenable. They could claim on one extreme to be simple pipes that carry other people's data, but the logical conclusion of that is that they should host everything, including child pornography, which is always brought up in these discussions, calls to kill certain classes of people, such as Jews, Muslims, or homosexuals. Or they could claim to be publishers and edit absolutely everything, which obviously would be financially untenable. Obviously, the solution, if it's anywhere, is somewhere in the middle. But the more fine-grained the monitoring, the more expensive it is. And their business model is based on large amounts of low-cost advertising, so at some point, it becomes uneconomic. But banning individuals or individual media outlets is far too blunt an instrument, and it could easily be used against people with other controversial views, people like myself. So maybe I'm just being selfish here. There is pretty much a blanket ban on criticisms of vaccines in the mainstream media, so it's not a reach to think that all vaccine critics could be banned from all social media outlets. Not just certain writings that offend sensitive pharmaceutical companies, but everything that person writes, even if it's photographs of their family. So, somewhat reluctantly, I have to say that banning Alex Jones is wrong. And again, that doesn't mean that I like everything that's on his channel. It doesn't mean that I like much of what's on his channel. But if progressives, people on the left, think that a trend of banning will end with the far right, they're mistaken. People with anti-war views, anti-pesticide views, anti-vaccine views, opponents to certain drugs or medical procedures could all be banned. And when they are banned, all of them will be banned, themselves or their organizations or companies. Finding excuses to ban people would not be difficult. Once the dam is open to crack, a flood will soon follow. I saw an article in the Los Angeles Times in August that I found interesting, with the title, "Coroner Sent Letters to Doctors Whose Patients Died of Opioid Overdoses. Doctors' Habits Quickly Changed." I found it interesting because it combined two of my interests, an interest in the side effects of modern medicine, as well as justice. Because it would be possible for the state to start going after these doctors, charging doctors who are believed to prescribe too much, which would probably quickly get bogged down because there are legitimate reasons to prescribe large amounts of opioids to people dealing with large amounts of pain. People, for example, who have had a large amount of chemotherapy or other cancer treatments have pain. And whether you believe that those treatments are going to be effective or not, I don't think you can question that those people are in excruciating pain and opioids are needed. So the state trying to decide exactly what amount of opioids, if any, are necessary for an individual is basically the state taking over the decisions of the doctors. So that wouldn't work, but it could end up with a few doctors being sent away to jail for a few years. But would that actually have an impact on the prescribing habits of others? What this article describes is how the San Diego County Medical Examiner's Office would send a letter to physicians whenever somebody died. This is a courtesy communication to inform you that your patient, and they entered the name and date of birth, died on, and they gave the date of death. Prescription drug overdose was either the primary cause of death or contributed to the death. Reading from the article, in the blandest of clinical language, The courtesy communication went on to inform the doctor of how many medication-related deaths the San Diego County sees each year, which are between 250 and 270. It offered five prescribing tips proven to help lower overdose death rates, and it steered the doctor to an online program designed to help medical professionals who are, quote, dedicated to avoiding prescribing controlled substances when they are likely to do more harm than good. It was part of an experiment to see if the number of overdoses could be reduced. These letters were sent out to 388 doctors. They also found another 447 physicians with similar prescribing habits who also had patients who died of overdoses, but they were not sent a letter. They were the control group. Compared with doctors who did not get a letter, those who did reduced the prescribing of opioid medications by almost 10% over just the three-month study period. These doctors started 7% fewer patients on opioids, and they were 3 to 4.5% less likely to write prescriptions for the highest doses of opioid medications, those most implicated in fatal overdoses. This is interesting because clearly the justice system is not going to be very effective at reducing this horrible epidemic of opioid abuse and death. This was not a punishment in any way. It was a private letter. The doctor could easily just throw it in the garbage, and perhaps some did. But it raised the awareness of the doctors to the consequences of their actions. Perhaps some doctors thought that if they didn't do anything, there might be punishments in the future. But one would imagine that if the doctor was a human being, they might suddenly realize that they were being lax, and if they tightened up their prescribing practices, they could actually reduce the death toll due to this drug epidemic. It was a very creative way to deal with the problem. In a world where still, whenever a problem exists, whether it's the problem of sexual abuse or anything, we immediately jump to, let's charge somebody with a crime and throw them in jail, even though the criminal justice system seems rather inadequate at actually changing behavior in the long term when there are powerful factors such as money or poverty that contribute to that behavior. Thank you for listening to episode 192 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. You can like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram @infectiousmyth. Commit to monthly donations of any amount at patreon.com/infectiousmyth. Until next week, thanks for listening, and goodbye.